Can you all hear me? Is this thing working? Okay, good. I'm Aidan. I'm a grad student at the University of Waterloo, and this is joint work with my supervisor, Chris Godsell. So the basic problem I want to talk to you about is the following. You're given a set of real numbers, a small set of real numbers, which I'll call the set A, which you can think of as a set of angles, and I'm going to look for a maximal set of vectors in a given complex vector space, a given dimension, such that if you take the inner product of any two of the vectors in the set, the absolute value of that is one of your given angles. So here the scalar product, this inner product here is just the standard complex scalar product, and we're usually going to think of this set of angles as a small set, so two or three numbers basically. So this is a problem which is very well studied in the real case. So if you're dealing with real vectors, and one reason for that is because there are not a lot of nice combinatorial implications in that case. So for example, if your set A has size 2, in the real case, this corresponds to a nice class of graphs called regular 2 graphs, and those have in turn have implications with or connections with sidal matrices and strongly regular graphs and a lot of other nice combinatorial problems. So it's well studied in that situation. The complex situation is not nearly as well studied. And I think the other reason for that is, well, and maybe it's just me banging my head against this problem for too long, but I think the complex case is a lot harder as well. So one reason for that is if you think about this product here, in the real case, if you're taking the absolute value, you've only got the absolute value is some constant alpha, then you've only got two choices, either plus or minus alpha. So you've got a lot of control over what's going on. And in the complex case, you've got an infinite number of choices. So, yeah, that's one reason why it's less studied. The other reason is that for a long time, there were really no applications for the complex situation. But recently, in the last 10 years or so, people have sort of come to realize that this is a very fundamental question in quantum computing. So in quantum computing, quantum states are represented by complex vectors. And measurements in quantum computing are represented by just this inner product, just taking the inner product of two states. So this has caused there's been a huge number of papers in the last 10 years or so on this type of question. In particular, there are two instances of this problem that I want to talk about today, and both of these come directly from quantum physics. So the first is called equiangular lines. So here I'm given a set of, basically my A set, my set of angles has size 2. So I'm looking for a maximal set of vectors in C to the N such that, any one vector taking the scalar product with itself is 1, so the vector is a unit vector. And if you take the product of any two vectors, you get some fixed constant alpha. So just as an example here, in C to the 2, these four vectors are going to be equiangular. So it's pretty clear that if you take this vector and take the inner product with this vector, then you're going to get 1 over root 3. And, the same with this vector with any of the other vectors, but you can verify that if you take the inner product with these two, you get the same value in absolute, or the same absolute value anyways. And in fact, 4 is the best you can do in C to the 2. We're trying to find a maximal set, and in C to the 2, 4 is the best you can do. So just by way of analogy, if you were to think about what's going on in the real case, the picture would look something like this. You're trying to find a maximal set of vectors in R squared, just in the standard plane, such that the angle between any two of them is the same, and it's pretty clear that 3 is the best you can do there. I just don't have a nice way of, if you have a nice way of picturing what complex higher dimensional vector spaces look like, I'd very much like to know about it. The second problem the second instance of this problem is called mutually unbiased bases. So here, I'm given, I want to find a maximal set of bases for C to the N, such that if I take the dot product of it, any vector with itself, I get 1, so every vector is a unit vector again. The inner product of any two vectors from the same basis is zero. So in other words, the bases are orthonormal. And the product of any two vectors from different bases is again a fixed constant, alpha. So here's an example of this. So in what I'm doing here is I'm just representing the bases by the columns of these matrices. So this is just the standard basis for C2. And if you take the dot product, the product of this vector with this vector, you get 1 over square root 2, and then you can verify that the product of any two of the columns here is also 1 over root 2 in absolute value. So one thing to notice here right away is that you can apply unitary operations, unitary matrices, to all the vectors in sight, and that's not going to change the angles you're dealing with. So in particular, what that tells you is that you can always assume that the standard basis is one of the bases in your set. And in the equiangular lines case, you can do a similar thing. You can always assume that one fixed vector of your choice is always in the set. So you take the first element in the standard basis, and that's always going to be in the set. And another thing that tells you is that, well, you know that if you take if this standard basis is in here, and you take the product of this vector with any other vector, that's going to force each entry in all of the other vectors to be a fixed absolute value. So every entry in every basis is going to have a fixed absolute value. That's called being flat. Excuse me. So another way of expressing that a set of bases are mutually unbiased is that if you take the matrix that represents the basis, and take the product of any basis with itself, you're going to get the identity matrix. And if you take the product of any two distinct matrices, then the result is going to be flat. The result, all the entries are going to have the same absolute value. So let me tell you what's known about the problem now. In the equiangular lines case, there's an upper bound on, we're trying to find a maximal set. And we know that no matter what the dimension is, if the dimension is n, then the best you can do is n squared. You can find at most n squared vectors. And when equality holds, well, I thought mathematicians were bad at coming up with names, but the physicists call this problem, when equality holds, symmetric informationally complete positive operator valued measurements. We know that equality holds in these cases here, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 19. And all of these results are pretty recent. The 2 through 5 were found in 1999 by Zauner, and then the other cases just sort of been added up in the last couple of years after that. But there is evidence that you can achieve equality for all values of n. And that was worked by these people in 2003. They sort of solved the problem numerically for all values of n up to n equals 45. So there's evidence that you can actually achieve a maximal set, which is what the physicists want. The physicists want to come up with n squared vectors in dimension n. In the case of mutually unbiased bases, the best you can do is find n plus 1 bases in dimension n. And it's known in this case that equality holds, so you can actually find n plus 1 bases in the case where n is a prime power. In the case of non-prime powers, really not much is known at all. We know that for any dimension n, you can find 3 bases, but there's not even sort of, nobody really has an idea as to whether or not it's closer to being n plus 1 or if it's closer to being 3. Well, there's a little bit more than that, but a little bit more than that is known. But basically, there's a huge gap. Like, for example, when n is 6, nobody can do better than 3, and we'd really like to know the answer there. The upper bound in both the equiangular lines and the mutually unbiased bases cases was established by Hudels and Seidel in 1975, and they're not physicists, they're combinatorialists. They were thinking about this problem long before the physicists were, but nobody worked on it for the 20-year gap in between just because nobody realized there were any applications. And then in 1980, Althoff established this equality for the case where n is a prime, And he was thinking about communication sequences, so he wasn't a physicist either. But then in 1989, the physicists sort of got into it, and Wooters and Fields proved that you can get equality for all the prime powers. So that's what's known. Next, I want to tell you a little bit about what we've done with this problem. So here's the first theorem. So you take an abelian group, call it G, and take a different set in that group. So it's just a subset of the group such that every element of the group occurs as a difference as elements of the different set, except for the identity. Then the characters of the group, restricted to that different set and suitably normalized, form a set of equiangular lines. So when I say the characters restricted to D, the characters are just functions from the group onto the complex numbers, just a homomorphism from the group onto the multiplication on the complex numbers. And so just take the restriction of that function to the different set. That will form a set of equiangular lines. And this is, for example, when n is n minus 1 is a prime power, this gives you n squared minus n plus 1 equiangular lines. So this is not what the physicists want. The physicists want n squared lines, and we're not quite getting there. But it does give you an infinite class, at least. And one other nice thing about this theorem is that it's combinatorial. A lot of the known results for equiangular lines don't really use any combinatorics. They're just sort of given a formula and then just verify it, or solve a system of linear program, or just come up with some sort of restriction on what's going on based on the angles. This at least has some sort of combinatorial motivation. So let me show you how to prove this. Let me give you an example first. So 0, 1, 3 is a different set in Z7, cyclic group. So here I'm just taking the characters of Z7, and you can just think of the characters as vectors in C7, and just taking the restrictions, so the elements that correspond to 0, 1, and 3. And so each of those is going to be a vector of dimension 3, and there are going to be 7 of them, and those 7 vectors are going to be equiangular. Okay, so now let me show you how to prove it. So I'm starting with any two characters, and I'm going to take the scalar product of them. And so by definition, that's just summing over the elements here, just summing over the elements of the different set. And then because it's a complex inner product, I've got to take the conjugate here once. And then if you multiply any two characters, well, first of all, the conjugate of a character is another character. And then if you multiply any two characters together, you get another character. So what I'm really doing is summing over some other character over the elements of the different set. So that's what this chi of D notation here is indicating. I'm just summing over the elements of the different set. And so I want to find the absolute value of that sum. And it's a slightly easier to find the absolute value squared. So it's just the value times its conjugate. And then taking the conjugate is the same thing as taking the negative of the elements in the group, because the characters are homomorphisms. And then here, so I'm taking the group and the negative of the elements of the group. And that's basically the differences in the group. So I'm getting every element of the group except the identity, because we've got a different set. And then if I take any single element of the group or in the different set and subtract from itself, I'm going to get the identity. So I'm going to get the identity size of D times. And so that's a constant. So what that tells you is you take any two characters like that, multiply them together, and you're going to get a constant. So if you normalize them appropriately, then you've got a set of equiangular lines. You just have to normalize them so that they're unit vectors. So you can do a similar sort of thing with mutually unbiased bases. Here you have to use something slightly more complicated than a different set. So I'm going to use a relative different set. So that is a subset of a group, again, an abelian group in our case, such that the differences in that set are every element of the group except for some subgroup N, which we call the excluded subgroup. So just let me give you an example here, a trivial example. The group is Z4, R is 0, 1, so the differences are 1 and minus 1, and so every element of the group shows up except for this subgroup here. A semi-regular relative difference set is one such that the size of the different set is equal to the excluded subgroup, and the size of the group is the square of the size of the different set. So in general, you can get restrictions on, well, all of these parameters are going to relate to each other in ways. You can come up with formulas which relate those parameters, and this is one of the ways they can be satisfied. So the theorem for mutually unbiased bases is that if you take a semi-regular relative difference set and take the characters restricted to that difference set and suitably normalize them, you get a set of mutually unbiased bases. And the proof is going to be very similar to the difference set case, the equiangular lines case. It's just checking out what happens when the characters are multiplied together. So this is, in some sense, a nicer theorem than the first theorem. One reason is it actually gives us what the physicists want. The physicists are looking for exactly n plus 1 mutually unbiased bases in dimension c to the n, and this theorem actually gives you that. The hard part here is finding a relative difference set, but those exist. They're not easy to find, but that's work that other people have done, so we don't have to do that. The other nice thing about this theorem is that all of the known maximal sets of mutually unbiased bases can be constructed in this way. So every formula that the physicists have come up with fits into this sort of category. Unfortunately, this theorem doesn't give us anything new because all of the MUBs that can be constructed this way were also already known. But what's useful about, or what is potentially useful about this theorem, is that it fits into a more general context that may give us either equiangular lines or mutually unbiased bases that aren't known. So this is the more general context. So I'm starting with a graph. It's going to be K-regular. It's going to be bipartite. And it's going to have an abelian automorphism group acting on each shore of the bipartition. So if I have that set up, then I can come up with a set of complex lines such that the scalar product and absolute value of any two of them is an eigenvalue of the graph. And so the number of lines I'm getting is d, where 2d is the number of vertices, and these are in dimension k, where k is the valency of the graph. So both of the previous theorems I mentioned fit into this context. So if you take different sets, you can put them into a graph of this form. If you take relative different sets, you can put them into a graph of that form as well. And just let me explain how that works. So if you start with a different set, you can come up with an incident structure based on that different set. Just by taking, well, if 0, 1, 3 is the different set, you just take sort of the rotations of that different set over the group. So 0, 1, 3, and then I'm just shifting. And so that'll give me a set of blocks, and then I've got a point block incident structure. And then I construct an incident graph from that structure where I put the points as one side, the blocks as on the other side, and I put a point adjacent to a block if the point is contained in the block. And so for both the different sets and the relative different sets, that'll give you a graph that fits into that context of theorem 3. So this we're hoping this will be useful, because there may be ways of relaxing these conditions in such a way that you can get new sets of complex lines that aren't already known. And so if we can relax this condition here, then there's a pretty good chance we'll come up with something that's new. And what we really want is to come up with mutual unbiased bases in non-prime powers, but we don't have that yet. So this is what we want to do for the future. First of all, we want to try and solve these two key problems in the cases that aren't known. So mutual unbiased bases for non-prime powers and equiangular lines for n greater than 8 and not equal to 19. Another thing we'd like to do is find graphs that fit into that theorem 3 in such a way that give us nice complex lines. And the third thing we'd like to do is come up with new proofs of the upper bounds, the n squared for equiangular lines, the n plus 1 for mutually unbiased bases. Right now, the proofs that are known for the for these upper bounds, when equality holds, you get a lot of information about what's going on with the lines. And so if we came up with other proofs, we might be able to get even more information. And hopefully that would lead to some new constructions. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you. I guess the major problem right now is that we need everything we're doing right now needs an abelian group.
Right.
So in that case, if you got the group, then you can go back and forth. But if you don't have the group, we're not really sure what to do.
There's like cheap certain